Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Phileas Club. As you know, I'm sure many of you know, this show is a monthly discussion between people from different parts of the world, and we try to cover the news with getting people's opinions from their perspective. And hopefully, usually, they have different perspectives. And that's what we do usually towards the end of the show, the end of the month, rather. But every month, we try to also do a special where we cover one specific topic. And today is that part of the show. We're going to be talking about the Indian elections. And that is going to be a pretty interesting and different kind of conversation, I'm sure. My name is Patrick Beja, and of course, this show is brought to you by its patrons at patreon.com/thephileasclub. So if you enjoy this kind of content, I would like to encourage you to go to that URL, which is available in the show notes, and maybe think about becoming a patron as well. It's a pretty cool thing to do. It helps the show, well, it enables the show to keep going, and I am eternally grateful and thankful to the people who already do. So a million thanks to all of the hundreds of people who choose to support the show on Patreon. So, my name is Patrick Beja. I'm not even sure I said that already, but I'm very glad to be welcoming two people to talk about the Indian elections, both of them originally from India and both of them living in the United States, which is perfect because I think they're going to be able to tell us what is different about the process and the logistics of this whole thing in India and in our Western democracies, and maybe try to point a few things out that we might not think about that might surprise, amuse, or interest us Westerners. The first one is a voice you might be familiar with if you've listened to the show before. Mayank is back on the show. Welcome back, and thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Very glad that you are available for this. We also have a newcomer whom I hope you will make feel welcome as well. Satya is here for the first time on the show. Thanks for being on, Satya.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks for having me today.
So I think what we're going to start with is maybe an introduction so that people can know a little bit of context about yourselves and know where you're coming from, both figuratively and literally. Let's start with Mayank. Can you tell the listeners who you are, where you're from, and what you're about?
Sure. My name is Mayank, as you already mentioned. I am originally from India. I grew up in the old walled city of Delhi, and I moved here. Well, not I came to US for studies when I was 19, but I have kept in touch with you know what goes on back home. My family, especially on my mother's side, is very like a lot of Indian families is very active into the political discussion. My grandfather, he was an active member of the Indian National Congress, the Congress Party as it is known colloquially. And I have been pretty passionate about politics, and this is probably a good opportunity to share some of my opinions, my whatever I know.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much. That's perfect. Satya, what about yourself?
Yes, my name is Satya. And I was born and brought up in the south part of India, in the state of Tamil Nadu. And I came to the U.S. When I was 25 years old, in like year 2000. So I still have most of my family in India, and I have good contacts with all of them. And I am very much interested in the politics, and I follow both the Indian politics and also the politics here in the U.S. And I like to keep track of what's going on and keep track of the current affairs in both countries. So I thought this would be a good opportunity for me.
And I'm very glad you got in touch, because actually you got in touch with me a long time ago when we did the Life in India special with Mayank, which was, what, I think like a year and a half, 2 years ago. And you told me, you know, that was a really interesting episode. I might be, you know, making the mention a little bit nicer than it was. But you said it was a pretty interesting episode, but growing up in the south of India, it was a very different life. So I'm glad we'll get a little bit of that perspective on this show.
Yes, yeah. It's a little different from where Mayank grew up. So I thought I would have like a different perspective on, because India is like a huge country with different cultures. So I thought maybe you'd be interested in knowing more about that.
And it's still possible we'll do another Life in India special to talk about that specifically. But the thing that, of course, everyone mentions when we talk about elections in India is that this is the biggest democracy in the world. And you say different cultures. It's true that India is so large that it's a bunch of, is it wrong to say a bunch of different countries put together? It's still India, but there are so many different environments and types of life, I guess, that it's not one monolithic culture. Even less, is it fair to say that? Even less than in other countries that are also large, like the US, which have very, very different cultures as well.
Yeah, U.S., I would say, is much more culturally, similar. I mean, India is still a country. There is still a concept of, you know, from the mountains to the sea. It's one country. But Indian cultures are similar yet so distinct that when I look at, like, the American culture, it feels like, okay, you know, they're pretty similar. Sure, they have some differences. They have a little bit different accents. But in India, we speak different languages. It is extremely common for people to be bilingual, trilingual. Even like a guy I knew who spoke four languages fluently, and it is not odd to have that. Mm. So yeah, it is culturally much more diverse than most countries I can think of.
Yeah, I would think like India could compare to Europe. You can think of it as like different countries inside a country. So, like Patrick, you live in France and Finland, so you know like the different cultures and difference between those two countries. Like India is kind of like that. Like if you move from state to state, you feel like you're in a different country altogether.
Would you say, from what you know, that the differences are as stark as between France and Finland, which are, you know, both parts of Europe and Western countries? So it's not, you know, comparing France to, I don't know, Botswana, but it's still very different. And you would say it's as different within India?
Yes, I would think so, yeah.
How many languages are spoken officially in are recognized as official languages in India?
There are 22 last I remember, but as far as the spoken languages, there are a lot more. There are a lot more dialects, but 22 officially recognized. And each state has the freedom to choose their state language. So I'm pretty sure Tamil Nadu, they use Tamil. In Delhi, it is Hindi.
Yeah.
How many states?
28 states now, and I think seven union territories. Am I right?
Yes, the union territories are like they are smaller size states. So they are like, they have some special status, but yeah, there are.
They are governed by the central government, and the states have their own legislative assemblies.
Right. Yes. So, and when we're saying 22 different languages, official languages, this is not, you know, English American to UK American.
No.
I mean, English English to American English. Yeah, no, it's actually different languages.
Yeah.
This is like French and Portuguese and Spanish and Italian and, you know, German. Like they all have, you know, distinct roots, you know, Sanskrit roots versus Tamil roots, but they are pretty distinct.
Right.
It is pretty much like Germanic languages versus Romance languages.
Right.
Yeah.
And just in case some people don't realize this, I'm sure everyone knows, but India has like 1.3 billion people. It represents 1.3 billion people. So when we say the largest democracy in the world and the largest election in the world, this is by far, and it's not by a small factor. Like, the largest following country I can think of as one country is probably the US, which has what, 250 million people?
320?
Okay. So 320, yeah. So that's like four times as much. And with, I'm guessing, one of the things I wanted to talk about, I think we're going to be talking about the context a little bit of like the political situation in India, but from a logistics point of view, there are, like, this might be a little bit of a caricature, but there are places that don't have roads. My wife was telling me about an article she read, which might, again, be a little bit of a caricature and a little bit of fun, but there are elephants bringing ballot boxes to remote villages because they don't have roads that can get there, which is kind of crazy. Like, you have such different environments, and the mountains, and the, you were saying, from the mountains to the sea, there are really remote places. From a logistics point of view, it must be like, it seems incredible that it works. I guess one of the questions would be, does it actually work? But logistically, is it, it must be very interesting to look at the way things happen in the US and then look at the way things happen in India, and there are many, many differences.
Yeah. So, Satya, please feel free to interject if I'm getting anything wrong, or if you have something to add. I'm just sharing what I know.
Yeah.
India has about 900 million eligible voters. So that number alone is bigger than most populations of most countries. So handling that, the Election Commission of India, it is one of the rare, departments, agencies, whatever you want to call it, that does its job really well. Handling the logistics is incredible. You know, potential 900 million voters, it's a huge number. And since there are so many voters in such a big country, elections, and when we talk about the general elections in India, these are the elections to elect the members of parliament for the lower house of the Indian parliament, the Lok Sabha, which is basically means the assembly of the people. So kind of like the House of Commons in the UK. And so the election is pretty much called, you know, the biggest festival, and it is being held in seven phases. So in each phase, there is a day of election where people in those constituencies which are up for election, they vote, and people in the US, they'll be really surprised to know that those days are a holiday for the people in those constituencies. they don't work, they don't have to go to work, they are expected to go and vote.
I think For anyone other than an American will seem completely normal. You either do it on a day which is on the weekend where people don't have to work, or you make it a holiday because it's important. Which leads me to a question, actually. Sorry to interrupt, but how politically minded, not active, but how politically minded are people in general in India overall? Do you know how many people actually go out to vote? What the percentage is of voters?
Turnout has traditionally been above 60%, around 60%, goes a little up and down. But when I see the numbers in US, which are like 34%, it's like super low. It's like, okay, 60% is considered low. 30% is like two-thirds of the voting population is not even interested.
So I guess I'm guessing the presidential election is higher in the US. That might be an average.
I remember like the past election, I remember it was maybe my memory is wrong. Mm. I mean, I remember it being above like 30-34%.
Wow,
some ridiculously.
No, I think the presidential, it's a little more higher.
Okay.
The midterm election is where it's like 30-35%.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
In France, for comparison, I'm looking at a number here which is closer to 80% in 2008 for the 2008 presidential election. But in France, it's about 80%, and it goes down when it's parliamentary elections. But usually for the big one, let's say in France, it's presidential, it's about 80%. Just to be certain, the general election you're talking about, so the election of the House in India, is the big one. That's where you get the prime minister from, right?
Lower House. Yeah, exactly.
Go ahead,
Satya. We don't have presidential.
The prime minister is actually one of the members of the parliament. So we don't elect a prime minister just for a prime minister. He's also a member of the parliament. And so the general election is where we elect all the members of the parliament, and the prime minister is one of them.
Mm. I see.
He's basically the leader of the party that gained majority, the party or the in India, they are coalitions. And he is invited then by the president to form a government.
Right, of course. So that's it works like in the UK and those countries. Usually it seems there are two systems. Either you vote for a president or you vote for parliament, and then they elect a prime minister. And I'm looking at other turnout statistics from the US, which might be a lot lower than what I initially thought. And I can't make out what they are now as we're recording the show, but it seems it's closer with what I'm looking at here. In 2016, it was closer to 55%. So I don't know what I'm getting wrong. I don't know. Well, I'm sure someone will correct us in the comments of the episode at frenchspin.com if you want to give us the actual numbers. Anyway, so we don't care about the US. We were talking about logistics in India. You were saying, Mayank, that the Election Commission is doing a really good job with those seven different days, which are holidays, thank God.
They do a really good job in sending, like you mentioned, some parts in the interior, the rural areas are still quite underdeveloped, but the Election Commission manages to send, their workers with the booths. They are sent every like in the US when I hear about, politicians are trying to restrict, who can vote and whatnot. And it's the complete opposite in India. Everyone is encouraged to vote. Every effort is made to make sure that every citizen has the opportunity to vote. And they're all, a free voter ID card, which also works as a sort of official ID for a lot of other things. So so there is no reason not to vote. I mean, I mean, people are given every chance to exercise their voting rights.
And it's something that is important to the Indian population to be, because I'm thinking, you know, my aunt actually travels to India fairly often. She spends a few months at every year there, and for some weird reason, she actually ended up in a very remote village that she has a very close relationship with now, and they actually didn't. They don't have electricity. They didn't have phones for the longest time. It's only a couple of years ago that they, maybe a little bit more, that they started having phones, and it feels like in these kinds of locations and remote areas, maybe Satya knows a little bit more about these things, but it seems like it would be easy to get into a situation where the elections feel very remote and you're not sure exactly how it's going to impact you, and then you're not so motivated to go out and do all the administrative stuff and vote. So I'm wondering if that there's a difference between the people in the big cities and the people in those very remote areas in that regard.
I would think that there are some very remote areas where they are not very motivated, but for the most part, most of the rural areas, they are pretty much very much motivated to go out and vote, because the most of the politicians, they kind of cater to the rural vote the most. You know, like most of them are farmers and they like to cater to their needs, and they make promises to make the farmers' life better, or like they say, like they'll bring roads and electricity to their villages. And so they are kind of, most of them are kind of motivated to go out and vote. So I feel like only in the cities, like some people are kind of think that like, it doesn't matter if I vote or not, nothing's going to change. And they have that kind of feeling. But if you are in like a remote village, if a politician says like, I will give you like 4 hours of free electricity for your farm, and I will put new roads for your community. And so they are more motivated to go out and vote.
That's interesting.
So, yeah.
And one more thing I would like to add to what Satya said, even though a lot of these people have very little education, a lot of them are, especially in the rural areas, education hasn't been, you know, especially with the poverty, it's not the topmost priority. So election commission makes sure that, and every party is required to have a symbol, you know, a little icon. And so election commission makes sure that the voting booth has those icons next to the party name, so that even if they cannot read which parties are listed, they can see from those little icons, those little symbols, that they know they can vote for whom they want.
How many parties are there? Because in the US it's very easy. You have two, so you either vote red or blue. It's very simple. I guess there are more.
There are a lot of parties in India. I think I'd mentioned this in the very first show I did, the special on India, that there are some national parties like the Congress Party and the BJP, but there are also very powerful regional parties who wield considerable political influence in their states. So a lot of times these so-called national parties, and I'm doing invisible, you know, air quotes, they have to form alliances with the regional parties, because they don't have that much influence in the states, in like many states.
I see. It leads me to a question. For some reason, I don't know where my mind went, why my mind went there, but do people trust politicians? I guess you partly answered that question, Satya, when you said in the cities some people say, it doesn't matter who I vote for. But overall, I don't know if there's a way to say overall in a country like India, but because there's a lot of distrust, especially recently, you know, in the last, let's say, 3-4 years in Western democracies about the entire, you know, disillusion about the entire political process more than there was before. How is it in India at the moment, since, you know, the elections are just happened? Is it similar? Is it, you know, still the big hope of democracy, which will represent the people, I wonder?
I would say, like, it's kind of similar. Like the more educated, more, like, urban people are kind of, they don't trust, I feel, the politicians that much. And but they still go out and vote, you know, like, they want their choice to win, but they don't have, like, very high expectations. That's what I feel. Like, they still go out and vote, they still participate, they debate, they fight over their parties, but yeah, I think they don't have, like, very high expectations. That's what I feel. Yeah.
And I'd just like to add that it is, I mean, most politicians, in my view, are extremely corrupt. I mean, when we are talking about corruption, we're not talking about, you know, a few hundred thousand from, like, you know, the way it is in US, like, oh, you know, some lobbyist gave them some money. These people are whales. I mean, they have, like, you know, what we call, you know, unaccounted for money, you know, black money, it is colloquially called in India. They are, a lot of them are super rich, super corrupt. And so especially, but every once in a while you see a politician like the current incumbent prime minister who are known for, you know, being extremely uncorrupt. I mean, PM, Prime Minister Modi, the current Modi, whatever his other faults are. You know, he can be a little arrogant. He can be a little, you know, assertive. You know, he likes to have his way or the highway. But one thing he's known for is not being corrupt. That he is that he tries to, you know, especially looking at the past governments, he has tried to not, you know, to kind of take care of corruption, to keep his government tight and, you know, a lean government instead of the bloated crap we had, you know, for the past few decades. So, yeah, I mean, an honest politician in any country is rare, and in India, it is even more so.
I do want to start talking about the different political forces at some point, but I feel like we'd be doing our listeners a disservice if we didn't talk about the logistics a little bit more. You know, I joked about the elephant thing. Is that actually happening, or is it like in one village maybe, or are there other things that might be surprising in the organization of this gigantic election?
I personally, I mean, I haven't seen that news item, but I have read that that even the remotest villages are sent the ballot boxes, and since it is India and party people can get aggressive, and they can be like in some rare instances, and it is not common at all, but there can be like ballot box snatching, or you know, in like very rare instances there can be violence. So security is provided. The Central Reserve Police Force, which is a union level, you know, police force, they provide security, and they also help. I mean, you'll see a ton of videos now that smartphones and Instagram are so common. You'll see a ton of videos of these soldiers helping like really old people just walk to the booth, and it is actually quite amazing that like people who are easily, you know, who can't even walk straight, they are so old, and you know, but they are still, they want to vote, and every help is given to them so that they can.
It's really also like when we are saying ballot boxes, we don't have ballot boxes anymore.
Yeah, not like physical ones. Yeah,
it's all electronic.
Yeah,
so Like, India was the first country, I think, to have all electronic voting. There's no paper at all, and everything is done electronically. And so that's, I think it's a big achievement, too.
Well, it seems in the case of India, it would make things more practical. But when we talk about electronic voting, the first thing that comes to my mind as a tech head is, wait, those can be hacked. And I guess in the context of the scope of the Indian election, it's so much more practical to do it like that. But that's not a concern for people, I suppose, the hackable nature of electronic voting.
It is a little bit of a concern, but people assume that it cannot be hacked. And they kind of like, since their voting is like in seven phases, so the places that voted first, they just lock the boxes, the electronic device in like a lock box and keep them secure till it's ready to be counted. And maybe only while the counting is going on, there's some possibility of hacking or something. But till then, they are like kept offline and they are kept in locked boxes.
And so everyone in all of those remote regions has to have a voter card, which they get before the election, correct?
No, they can... sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. They don't get it right before the election. They can get it anytime they want. So it's like an ID card, yes.
Right. But I mean, yeah, you register and there's an administrative thing that happens and you're registered and then you show up to the electronic thing with your ID card and it shows who you are and you can vote. And that's the way you make sure that there isn't like ballot stuffing and whatever, and that people vote who are supposed to vote.
Well, since it is electronic, there cannot be like, you know, physical ballot stuffing.
Of course.
And as far as like registration goes, I Satya can confirm this. I don't think we have to register in advance, you know, like who we are and where we will be voting. We are supposed to when we get our voter ID, we say, you know, which constituency we'll be living in and where we'll be voting. And as soon as we change, like let us say that I move from Delhi to say, you know, Kanyakumari, just to give an extreme example, I would be expected to update the election commission on the fact that I have moved constituencies and my new constituency where I will be voting will be this one. So
it's the same. It's similar in France, and I'm sure in many, many countries. So it makes sense. The impression I get from everything you're both telling me is that everyone, the government included, but not only the government, considers the election to be an important matter, which seems obvious. But I think the more, you know, again, recently, a lot of people seem to be thinking, you know, either it's rigged or it doesn't matter, or the government can do a good job doing this and that, which, I mean, in France, we consider elections to be well handled, but it's also so much easier because of the scope of the country. But it would be easy, I think, for a country like India, for people to think, oh, it can't really be done. It's so big and so difficult. But the impression I get is everyone is looking at this and thinking, yeah, it's really tough and we're going to do it right and it's going to work out. Like I sense an attachment to democracy, which I also sensed when we were talking about this earlier, and when I get, you know, the media vibe, which is this is the largest democracy in the world. I feel it's said with pride. I wonder if that's my impression or if you feel it too, both of you.
Yes, Patrick, you're very correct. Like we have like a good amount of pride on being like the largest democracy and being like being a democracy in the first place, because it's so hard to like be in a country with so many different different languages and religions and cultures to maintain like a single unit, you know, for such a long time. So I think it is ingrained in our culture to be like to be proud of our democracy, and we are taught that in schools from the very early age, like democracy is very important and we cannot move away from it for any reason. Yeah.
And I would just like to add that I'm not sure which other country which was colonized is not has never. I mean, India is one of the rare countries where after the British left, or you know, in the case of like, you know, Indochina, you know, after the French left or whoever, after decolonization. I'm not sure which other country except India has not had a coup or have, you know, like a dictatorship or like military rule. I mean, as far as I know, India has been the only stable democracy, which is actually a democracy and not a facade for some dictatorship or like some military junta or whatever.
Right. This might be a really dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do Indians feel Indian? Like, even with the, you know, 28 states and difference in culture, and is there national unity? Maybe it might be extreme to say throughout the entirety of the country, but as a whole?
I mean, I feel pretty Indian. I mean, whenever I introduce myself to someone, I don't say I'm, you know, from Delhi or I'm from the north. I say I'm Indian.
I guess, but you both live in the US, and when you live outside of your country, I think people tend to become more from where they're from. So I don't know if that's a fair question to ask both of you. But
yeah, like I would say that in the last 30, 40 years, it has been more like we are more considering to be Indian, because you know we have like all the like they say the world has shrinked or something like that, so we have more understanding and more news and more information about people living in all parts of the country, and we can easily communicate with each other. We travel all over the country now, so I would say like we have more kind of feeling that we are all Indians, we are all in this together now than ever before, I would think. Yeah.
Yeah, the economic development, especially with the liberalization post 1990s, has created so much. The economic boom kind of allowed a lot of people to move all over India for different jobs, etc. You know, really, really quickly. So there are like a ton of North Indians living in South India, and South Indians living in the North, and Indians are a lot more mobile within the country. So it has shattered a lot of sort of preconceptions and stereotypes that a lot of, you know, like Indians can be very stereotypical of other Indians. I'm not going to mince words about that. Sometimes the stuff I hear from people of like, you know, my grandma's generation, I'm like, are you serious? You're being racist towards other Indians. It is amazing. but overall, I would agree with Satya that Indians do consider themselves a lot more Indian now with the national integration happening
I guess the internal quote-unquote racism is found in to different degrees in any country. If you hear, you know, New Yorkers talk about Texans, I'm sure, or Alabamans, I'm sure you can find some of that, and vice versa. Yeah. And same in France, if you hear them talking about, you know, Parisians talk about people from the south and vice versa, it's always a little bit interesting. But yeah. All right, I I do want to talk about the political forces, but last question before we do, I'll start with Satya and then ask Mayank as well. Maybe I should have asked you beforehand so you had time to prepare, but I'll try it anyway. If there's one thing in the logistics of the elections that you think Westerners wouldn't expect about the Indian election, what would it be? You know, it can be the elephants or the different languages or the icons or images that you use. Something that would surprise us. What do you think it would be? First Satya, and then we'll go to Mayank.
I think what would surprise the Westerners is the standardization of all the voting machines and all the, you know, if you compare it to the US, like each place has a different kind of a voting machine. It's kind of each one has a different kind of polling sheet, and it's kind of sometimes confusing, and like each city, each county has a different type of counting. But it's in a country like India where nothing is standard throughout the country, but they managed to make the voting machines and the voting process like a good standard and same throughout the country. So no matter where you live, you get the same experience when you go to vote. And that's kind of a thing that I think is missing in the US, especially where like each county has like a different voting machine, a different design of ballot, and it's very confusing sometimes that, you know, that caused the Bush-Gore election. So, yeah, I think in India, it's very amazing. Like, we have like a standard system of voting. So no matter where you go, you get the same experience.
And I guess it's guaranteed that you know how it works and that it works well. I guess there's, you know, this ever-present suspicion towards the federal government in the US, which is I think everyone's suspicious towards government in any country, but to the US it's such an extreme that we often say this in this show because we look at it from the outside. It's very okay, that might be it becomes counterproductive, I guess. But it seems in India there is trust in the federal government, or at least
for the elections.
Mayank, anything that would surprise people?
I mean, for one, you know, the Election Commission is extremely honest and, you know, very efficient. You know, I mean, that alone shocks me many times because the rest of the Indian bureaucracy is just a, you know, massive pile of whatever. But
why is that, though? How come, I guess, everyone understands that if that part didn't work, it would all collapse? Is that why?
Yes. Yeah, there is some of that. And somehow it is also the culture. The culture has somehow developed that the Election Commission does its job. You know, it is just like a sort of there are departmental cultures, right? It's just a culture that the Election Commission will do its job. And and I would say the other thing, as far as the logistics go, I think I might have mentioned this before, but this is like what kind of annoys me when I hear stuff in US about voter ID. Like, you don't have to show your ID. Give everyone a free ID. That's what happens in India. Give everyone a free ID and show that ID when you come to vote. Like this whole debate in the US about, oh, you know, people shouldn't have to show ID because they are poor and, you know, they don't have ID. Okay, first of all, most people have a driver's license. And if they don't, make a department, make something, I mean, US has a department of everything, make a department of identification that does this and just provide free IDs for everyone so that there is no debate about, oh, poor people don't have ID, so they don't have to do it, so they shouldn't have to show ID.
I think this is something that strikes me as well very strongly when the discussions happen in the US. I think it has to do with the distrust of the federal government and of identification in general, which becomes, as I said, counterproductive. I also think there is very little election fraud with the system as it is now. It's been proven many times that actually the system as it is now works in that regard. So the thing that, you know, initially I would have thought, yes, of course, why don't you do that just like you are now? But I'm not sure there is as much a need for it as, for example, something else, which annoys me to no end when we talk about the US, which is making a voting day a holiday. That would be so much more important. Or just hold them on the Sunday, for heaven's sake. I was going to say a worse word.
Sunday, I can understand there are a lot of religious communities. For them, it is the Sabbath. You know, they don't want to go outside and vote.
Okay. Well, but make it a holiday.
Yeah. Like use a Monday and it is, you know, and it'll make it a long weekend and make it a holiday so that people like me who can't vote, who don't, who are not, who are not American citizens, can enjoy that holiday.
And I mean, I guess the counter argument there is that you can vote in advance or by mail or stuff like that. And sure, you can, but in practice, many people don't. And so, anyway. All right, so let's talk about the political forces in India and this recent election. Can you tell us, I guess anyone, any of you, either of you is fine, but what are the major political forces, what the landscape, what does it look like with the political tendencies and how it went this time? I guess let's start with Mayank and then we'll go to Satya.
Okay, time to start fighting because politics is very sensitive topic in India, and
it is everywhere, I'm sure.
No, but I mean people are super passionate about it, and it makes it sometimes it can be a little uncomfortable, and we'll see how that goes with Satya and I. I'm not sure where he lands on the political spectrum back home. But yeah, so like we had talked about earlier, India has some national level parties like the Congress Party and the BJP.
What's the BJP? What does that stand for?
BJP stands for Bharatiya Janata Party, which literally means Indian People's Party.
Okay.
So they have. And people might recognize the Congress Party's name. They have been kind of there since the beginning. They can trace their roots to one of the original political parties that were formed back in the 1800s, late 1800s, and they trace their roots to there. But the current Congress Party looks nothing like that. And they have traditionally relied on this very dynastic this political dynasty, basically the Gandhi family, Nehru Gandhi family. And just so people know, this Gandhi family has nothing to do with Mahatma Gandhi. just to clarify,
yes,
same last name, but that is it. Nehru was the first Prime Minister of India. His daughter, Indira Gandhi, married a Parsi named Feroz Gandhi, and her son Rajiv Gandhi, and basically this is a political family, and they have basically ruled India for most of this family has ruled for especially in the beginning they were pretty much the party, and they ruled pretty much continuously, and BJP.
Let me interrupt you for a second. Where would we put them on the political spectrum, for Westerners to understand? Right, left, center?
They were pretty left of center, really left. Nehru was a very big socialist. I mean, he was enamored with the Soviet model, and that is why India was a mixed economy, kind of a mixture of state-run and private economy, from 1947 to about 1992 or 93, when the economic reforms happened. So yeah, he was pretty left of left of center, really left. And so his daughter, Indira Gandhi, who pretty much succeeded him. I mean, there was another prime minister between the death of Nehru and his daughter, Indira. A very good guy called Shastri, but yeah, this family has pretty much ruled India and been to the left quite a bit. But, sorry, just one quick thing: the way left and right are defined in the U.S. and especially like the Western democracies is not how you would characterize left and right in India, because almost all political parties are for economic growth, and some political parties, you know, do promise more stuff like, oh, we'll give free money to the poor or free services, mm-hmm. and some other parties will say, you know, especially the sort of the right to center parties will be more focused on, you know, like a lot more economic development instead of just handing out free stuff. And also as far as, you know, like foreign policy and sort of the military part of it, you know, the right tends to be a little more hawkish in its foreign policy than the left. Left has traditionally been pretty docile, but it is not the same left and right as what you might think in France or Britain or the US or wherever.
So there's more things that they have in common, or?
Yeah, I mean, there are more things they have in common, and a lot of the things which define the left and the right. And I would say it's not even the left and the right. It's just, you know, two different sort of political, you know, thoughts or ways of thinking. It is not defined as left and right in India.
Okay, so the BJP being the other one, you talked a little bit about the Congress Party, and the BJP is the other one. I'll ask you how you would explain what it is, and then I'll go back to Satya.
Okay, BJP originated out of a party called Janata Party, which was itself formed from a bunch of other parties, which were focusing primarily on kind of like the welfare and sort of the for the benefit of Hindus, because I mean, we can get into a lot of, you know, communal stuff here, which is basically talking about religion, because religion has been one of the big things, you know, that, you know, there's no way to avoid it. It has been part of politics in India since the beginning. I mean, the very creation, the very fact that India was split into the unified India was split into India and Pakistan was based on religion. So it came out. BJP came out of the, you know, came out of the this a bunch of parties which were focused on more on like the Hindu identity, but they have been making a lot more, you know, kind of they've been moving towards center, trying to be inclusive a lot more. And the current prime minister, again, Satya, might have a different opinion. But, you know, for all the stuff, you know, for all the crap I read in the news, his actual policies, the current prime minister's actual administration, all the schemes he has launched, all the And schemes is not the bad word. It's not a, you know, scheming scheme. Mm-hmm. It's like all the different, you know, things he has done. They have been incredibly inclusive, and when you actually see what he has done, there is not even a shred of like there's not even a hint of you know, oh, this development he did or this as a matter of fact, he managed to electrify 99% of the villages in India, and I mean villages, not homes, not like individual homes, but at least, I mean, these villages didn't even have electricity, you know, they couldn't even get electricity in their village, much less individual homes, and he has managed to make that happen, you know, for 99% of villages, which is which is quite an accomplishment.
Well, that's probably the village I was talking about in the Himalayas that my aunt goes to regularly. When she first went there a few years ago, they didn't have electricity, and it showed up 1 year. I guess that might have been part of that effort.
So he has been incredibly inclusive. None of his actual policies, I mean, some of the things he did with the economy, like the demonetization, were not, they were a good idea, but implemented poorly. But religion has not been a part of his actual, work. Okay. And so they have been trying to move a lot to the center. And again, Satya, might have a different opinion. I don't know. But since there's nothing else to talk about, the opposition has constantly been trying to bring up, religion. And the funny part is, this is what makes me laugh. Modi himself, even though he's a Hindu, he's from like a really low caste. He's from what government classifies as other backward classes. He's an OBC, so he's like a really low caste Hindu who was the son of a poor tea stall owner. He comes from nothing, he comes from really poor background. He's not corrupt. So it's all been about religion. And they've been, throwing personal attacks at him, calling him a thief, even though there's no basis on there. I mean, it has just been a very kind of, like politics in India can be pretty dirty. They can be a lot of low blows. But I actually admired the guy despite whatever other faults I find in him. He took the high road until he said enough is enough, and then he started hitting back.
Okay.
To Rahul Gandhi, who is the current prime ministerial candidate, even though he has never had any administration experience ever. So this is pretty much, I mean, right now it is pretty much a slugfight between Congress and BJP and their regional allies. That's how it is going.
Okay, so there are these two main parties, I'm guessing are the two major ones. I'll turn to Satya, ask a couple of questions. First, are there any other parties that matter? Because, in the US there are two parties only, essentially. But in Europe, usually you have, two main parties, but also a number, three, four, five other parties that that can weigh in the elections. So are there parties like that? And actually, I have another question about logistics. Do you have two-turn elections or just one-turn election?
The elections are just one turn.
One turn. So you vote, you decide, and it's done. Okay. And so the party that gets the most votes...
The two-turn elections would make sense if we were actually electing directly electing a president.
Right.
But since we are electing a member of parliament, one-turn elections work.
I understand. Satya, would you agree with the description that Mayank gave? And are there other parties? And then maybe can you tell us how things went this year, this time?
I would say I agree with Mayank for the most. Yeah, the BJP party, I think it's what we would call a right-wing party here, because their origins was from a religious group. But right now, I think the Western media kind of exaggerates what the BJP's religious extremism is about, but I don't think they are as extreme as the Western media portrays them. So I think I agree with Mayank on the BJP and the Congress. I agree with him. So about the other parties, there are other regional parties that are powerful in their own state, but they do form a coalition with the national parties so that they can form a government. And in my state of Tamil Nadu is where the regional parties actually started, I would say. Like during the 60s, the Congress was the most powerful party in the whole of the country, and they were trying to impose the national language on all the states. They wanted to everybody to learn and do things in the national language of Hindi. So some people in my state, they did not like that. And so they started what's called as the anti-Hindi movement. Mm. And because they want to stay with their own language, our regional language. So that's how the regional parties started in my state. So they became very powerful, and they split into two, and now there are two regional parties. So always it's either one or the other becoming the chief minister of the state. The chief minister is the governor of the state. So one of the parties, they align with either one of the national parties, so that when they form the government in the center, the regional parties either align with either one of the, either they go with the Congress or they align with the BJP to form the central government. So as far as in my state is concerned, the national parties will never be able to become chief minister in my state. It'll always be either one of the two regional parties. So many states it's like that. So yeah. So
can I just add one thing?
Okay.
Satya mentioned that chief minister is the governor, but I would just like to clarify that each state does have a governor. But again, the governor is a ceremonial, mostly ceremonial position, like the president, and chief minister is the one just like for the national election, they run the things. So just to clarify that.
Yeah, the governor in the U.S., a state governor. So that's how the chief minister is there for India.
Okay.
So So that's how the regional parties work. So they are very powerful in their own states. And when it comes to forming a central government, the national parties ask, will you join? They will join with either one of them, and they'll form
a
coalition.
Try to form the coalition, yeah.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. So how did it go this time? I have to be honest, I haven't even followed the election at all, so I'm very curious to hear the end of this episode myself.
Well, it is not finished yet. I think I mentioned before, it happens in seven phases. The last election will be, I think, on the 19th, if I'm not wrong. And,
yes. Uh-huh.
And the counting will be done on 23rd. But from all the projections, the BJP-led National Democratic Alliance is still poised to win the election, to have the majority, and unless something drastic and amazing and really crazy happens, he will be the next prime minister again. At least that is what it is looking like right now.
Mm,
but
okay.
But the outright simple majority that BJP got, I mean, they still had to form a coalition. But the really strong, amazingly, one of the strongest performances any national party had, the previous election, the BJP won't be that powerful this time. And I think in some ways it is for the good, because I think BJP got, especially Prime Minister Modi, got a little overconfident and tried out really like outlandish ideas. I mean, I shouldn't say outlandish, but they got a little arrogant and in his effort to root out corruption, he did some things which didn't go as well with the public as it could have, as it should have. And so in a way it is good that he will have, he won't be as powerful as he was. So it'll be, he'll have to be a little more tempered in his ideas. But that is what it is looking like right now. And just so we know that there are that there are these two alliances, the National Democratic Alliance led by BJP and the United Progressive Alliance or Unified UPA is led by Congress, but there's also a bunch of parties that have formed a third front, but that is more of like their ploy to kind of, you know, remain outside of these two coalitions until such time, that eventually they might be needed, and then they can, do some sweet talking with whoever the winner is, and get some concessions to join the alliance, one more thing I would like to mention. This is something I think I mentioned the first episode I did. People would be really surprised to know, especially in Western democracies, that communist parties are still a thing in India. Like the state of Western Bengal, for the longest time, they would keep electing bringing back the communist party, and it is kind of like, it makes your head hurt with sort of the contradictions of having a communist party be elected, but it is a thing in India. Communist parties, even though they have declined, and socialism and some of those, really out there ideas have kind of, died down a little bit. But especially in the states of Kerala and West Bengal, communist parties are still a thing.
I think it's surprising in many former communist parties, communist countries, the communist parties are doing pretty well still. So that's interesting, but it will be a discussion for another time. I guess we will have to wait, as you said, to have the final word on the actual election. But that will probably bring us to a close. Before we finish the show, I want to give a couple of minutes to Satya if you want to conclude and tell us anything we missed or anything you want to add before we close off the show. Satya, you have the floor.
So we'll be waiting anxiously for the election results on 23rd, and like Mayank said, BJP is going to win, probably is going to win, but it's a good thing that we have some more balances, what they call checks and balances on the BJP party, because they especially in some areas, they kind of get too arrogant and they cause a lot of issues. So I think it'll be good to have some kind of balance so that they don't think they're like the most powerful party, because last time they got a pretty good mandate, and I think this time it'll be nice to have some kind of balance between the two parties. And yeah, that's all I had. I don't have anything else.
Sure. Well, Oh, go ahead.
That
was really interesting. Thank you very much to both of you for having been on and giving us this look inside the mostly the logistics of this surprising largest democracy in the world. Before we leave, I'll give each of you an opportunity to tell us where we can find you on the internet if you so wish. I know Mayank is still discreet about his online identity, so I'm guessing it's still Mayank for now.
I have been some things have been rolling around my head. I have been thinking of starting a little show of my own, but I need to create time in my schedule. But
no worries.
When I do kind of get around to it and have everything set up and start putting out something that I think I can share with the world, I will definitely let you and everyone who listens know.
Excellent. Looking forward to that. Satya, what about yourself? Do you have an online little corner of the internet that you want to talk about?
Actually, I don't actually.
Okay, so I don't. No worries.
Yeah. My Twitter handle is Satya, SATYA893.
But, oh, there you go. Okay.
It's just like a read only. I just read other people. I don't tweet that much. Yeah.
That's so fine. If people, you're still reading stuff. So if people want to go ask you questions, I guess they can do that there.
Sure. Yes, sure. Yeah.
Excellent. The link will be in the show notes. And for me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can follow me there. And if you want to discuss what we talked about, you can do that on the FrenchSpin.com website, where I host the shows I produce. So feel free to do that. And of course, if you appreciate this this content, if you like this show, you can go to patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The link is in the show notes as well. And contribute. Become a supporter. Not only will you get the additional content that I post there sometimes, the bonus content, but also you will join the community and be very proud to be supporting the show, I hope. I mean, if you like it, hopefully you'll be proud to support it. So thank you so much to those who already do that. And thank you to both of you, Mayank and Satya, for being on with me. And we will be back in a few weeks, either for a regular episode at the end of the month, if I can swing that, or if not, another episode in June. So enjoy your days until then, and we'll talk to you at that point. Bye, everyone.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.